Welcome to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on globalization, both its risks and its rewards. It has created great wealth, it's lifted millions from poverty, but it's also left many behind, creating great disparities in both income and opportunity. In this program, we'll hear from Arvind Gunnison, Director of the Business and Human Rights Division at Human Rights Watch, Paula Goldman, Global Lead for Impact Investing at Omidyar Network, and Paul Rice, President of Fairtrade USA. The conversation is moderated by Matthew Bishop. He's the Globalization Editor for The Economist. The program was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Matthew Bishop.
It's now my pleasure to introduce my fellow panelists. Over on the far side is Paula Goldman, who is a Senior Director and Global Lead for Impact Investing at Omidyar Network. Next to her is Arvind Gunnison, who is the Director of... I should look before I speak. Next to her is Paul Rice, who's the President and CEO of Fairtrade USA. And then Arvind Gunnison is right next to me, who's the Director of Business and Human Rights at Human Rights Watch. Our theme is, I think, a really timely one, because globalization has become increasingly controversial again in the past few years, after having been quite controversial at the end of the 1990s. There is a sense that the growing integration of the world has made the world flatter and smaller, but also there's quite a lot of bumpiness along the way, and that it's created losers as well as winners, and presented sort of really significant challenges as well as significant opportunities for people like our panelists who are in the business of improving the state of the world through their organizations. You know, clearly there have been issues around supply chains and the abuse of workers in those supply chains. We had the terrible Rana Plaza disaster in Bangladesh a few years ago that really highlighted the vulnerable conditions that many people work in. We've also seen cross-border movements of people, refugee crises and so forth, that are particularly hitting Europe at the moment due to war, but also due to climate change and other issues around the growth of cities and so forth. And there's lots of questions about, you know, the emergence of human trafficking on a larger scale than had previously been thought, and also of, you know, people being driven out of common land into, you know, by big corporations sort of doing mining and so forth. So a whole range of different issues. And I want to start by asking each of our panelists to really tell us briefly about how, from the perspective of their organization, they see the balance of risks and rewards. You know, how much has globalization been a force for good in the work that they're doing, and how much a negative factor, and above all, what is the issue that they are most vigorously engaged with at the moment? And I'm going to start with Paula.
Sure. So first of all, it's such a pleasure to be here today, and I'm really looking forward to getting into this. So I work at Omidyar Network. We've been around for about 11 years, and we're essentially an impact investing firm, right? Which means that we aim to use the power of markets to improve access to opportunity, by and large, for disadvantaged populations around the world, mostly in emerging markets. Oftentimes when we get into discussions of globalization, they're very ideologically driven or sort of black and white. I would say, and it's just sort of, it's so complex, and so there's so many things going on sort of all at once. But at Omidyar Network, we tend to focus on what are the opportunities that are being created, right? And one of the things that's been really driving us lately is looking at what's going on in emerging markets, the rise of middle classes, the dramatic spread of smartphones and technology, increase of capital flows in emerging markets. And so you see this, we're increasingly concentrated on this opportunity of this, like, low and lower middle income populations, folks that have disposable income. They may not have had before, but now it's about $3 trillion a year. And all of a sudden, there's opportunities for businesses to serve their needs and give opportunity, whether it's through solar lighting for people that don't have access to regular electricity, or it's alternative credit scores so people can take out a loan and start a business. This can make the difference between an income shock that will send people back into poverty or having folks join the established middle class, right? And this is actually the report that we put out last week on the topic, frontier capital, out there on some of the tables. But that's really where we're grounded and focused.
And yeah. In a nutshell, I mean, why, given these big trends towards the middle class emerging and opportunities at the bottom of the pyramid, why does it need a sort of firm based here in the Bay Area to be investing capital out there?
Well, no, certainly we also do a lot in the U.S. But it's interestingly, if you think about limited capital and where can an amount of capital, let's see, over the years, we've deployed around $850 million, about 400 for-profit and 450 nonprofit grants. This maybe seems like a lot of money, but it's sort of a drop in the bucket, right? So you think about where can this get deployed most effectively and where is it filling a gap that is not otherwise happening? Like the capital markets here, I mean, Silicon Valley, awash with capital right now, right? Emerging markets, increasing capital. Emerging markets, low and lower middle income groups, less so, right? So we feel like we have a comparative advantage and impact there.
So Paul, I mean, you focus on fair trade and particularly supply chains and so forth. And there's been, I mean, I guess the first wave of globalization, companies like Nike and others were targeted because they seem to be using sweatshop labor, maybe child labor in the developing world. Mm-hmm. Are things been getting better now in the past few years?
Most definitely. First of all, good morning, everyone. Yeah, so fair trade is actually trying to harness the power of globalization to lift farmers and workers around the world out of poverty. And to your point, we're finding now that global brands and retailers are increasingly looking for a way to make the supply chain more transparent, for a way to really understand what's going on the other side of the world where their products are being manufactured. And I think we've seen in the last 20 or 30 years that globalization, the lowering of trade barriers, has accelerated global trade and it's created tremendous economic wealth, even in some of the poorest countries in the world. But we also know that that wealth is not trickling down and the poorest of the poor are being left behind by globalization. And so, concretely, we work with farmers around the world. There are 450 million smallholder farmers in the world today in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, 450 million. They produce over half the world's food. And most of those smallholders live in very small, remote villages. They don't have access to capital. They don't have access to training and technical assistance. And they don't have access to markets. Typically, they will sell their coffee or their bananas or their corn or their beans in the local market to a local middleman for a tiny fraction of what they could get if they were selling direct to the global market. And so, for me, therein lies both the challenge of globalization and the opportunity, because if we can help those smallholders develop the skills they need, access the capital that they need, and access the market directly, and jump over the middlemen, if you will, and come direct to the market with a more direct and transparent supply chain, then those farmers are going to get much, much more money for their harvest. They're going to improve their livelihoods. And the brands and retailers that are buying their products are going to have a much more transparent and traceable supply chain where they have more security that there isn't child labor or that bad labor practices are not being implemented.
Great. We'll come back and talk about that some more. Arvin, tell us from the human rights perspective, is this globalization process a big factor and has it been helping improve human rights or in some ways making it worse?
I mean, I think it's both. And for an organization like ours or for Human Rights Watch, first of all, thanks everybody for listening to all of us as well. It's had a dramatic effect on the way we do work. I mean, I've been at Human Rights Watch a long time and I can remember how transformative even basic things like email, social networking, YouTube, and others are on human rights writ large. It has trained the world in the sense that now everybody can document violations or stand up for their rights. And for organizations like ours, it has given us scope and reach into parts of the world no one would have had 20 years ago. So it's undeniable that globalization has given more voice to human rights in some fundamental ways. The downside to that is that globalization has given more voice to human rights in many ways, which means there's more reasons to look at what's happening with human rights. And from that standpoint, I think the key lesson of globalization, at least for us, is that whenever you see a rapid expansion in, say, economic growth and economic activity, it's undeniable more wealth will be created. It's also undeniable more people will be lifted out of poverty. But equally true is if there isn't enough scrutiny and there isn't the right regulation or oversight, there will be excesses against the most vulnerable. And you see that over and over again, whether it's in the US or abroad with slavery or child labor, or even more predatory practices against vulnerable communities. So I think what globalization shows is that if you look at history in the US, for example, the Gilded Age and the Great Depression were accompanied by great waves of social change and social regulation. And globalization, what we're seeing now, is the need for that all over the world. And the role of a human rights watch fundamentally is to be one of those institutions that can scrutinize what's happening at the excesses and to the people that are most vulnerable. Because on the whole, globalization can be beneficial for a lot of people and has been, but there's always going to be a need to pay attention to what's going wrong as well.
And as you look around the world at the moment, where do you see the greatest progress on human rights and where do you see the biggest problems?
Well, from the standpoint of globalization, I mean, even if you look at the last 15 years, 15 years ago, one of the first reports we did on a company and their need to respect human rights was Enron. And I joke today that today Human Rights Watch is worth more than Enron. And the reason for that is because at the time, nobody in the private sector really felt they had human rights obligations. And today, it's not a discussion anymore. So what we've seen even in the era of globalization is it's not just governments or human rights organizations or foundations or others. It's every part of society recognizes there's a human rights responsibility and obligation on their part. And that's a pretty substantial and transformative development. Now, whether they put that all into practice is a separate issue. But I do think that there has been progress. But at the same time, there have been some challenges. Number one, governments see this too, and a lot are restricting the space in which civil society can work, in which technology can be used openly, and in ways that citizens can actually hold their own institutions accountable. And similarly, there are countless practices by not high-profile companies or businesses, but a range of actors that are still quite dubious and warrant further scrutiny. And then finally, a big issue is we're not in an era where governments as a whole are willing to regulate on social grounds. In other words, there is more resistance to passing better labor laws, passing better child labor laws than there ever was before, in part because the factors that create globalization create certain challenges, but also the political environments aren't conducive to it. So that creates issues as well.
So Paul, I mentioned Rana Plaza earlier in the conversation, and so many people died in that factory fire, and there was a great outpouring of concern from retailers that they were going to change their practices and so forth. Has much changed since then in that sector, do you think?
Not enough. Not fast enough. I think when I look at what's happened in both the world of brands and retailers over the last 20 or 30 years in terms of sustainability, it's clear that companies have been able to move more quickly on the environmental sustainability agenda than on the social and labor sustainability agenda, right? And I think many of the achievements that we've made in terms of reducing carbon emissions, reducing packaging and pollution, waste, all of those advances also create costs for the firm, or reduce costs for the firm. So it's easier to move forward and justify it in terms of the bottom line. On the social side of sustainability, often what is required is better wages or better working conditions, more worker safety and health practices in factories and on farms. And we're still trying to figure out how to do that in a cost-effective way. And one of the things that fair trade does is says this is a more responsible and more sustainable product, and the consumer needs to help sustain that by paying a little bit more for a fair trade product.
And the thing I hear from companies all the time is, you know, we would like to do this, but the consumer won't pay.
Now, and you actually, consumers won't.
And they exactly. won't, yeah.
So that really creates, I think, a challenge for capitalism, how to make supply chains more sustainable on the social and labor side, how to mitigate the reputational risk of a factory falling down on the heads of the workers and brands being implicated. But then beyond the reputational risk issue, there's just the issue of supply chain security, right? Because when factories fall down, or labor strife shuts factories down, or when climate change impacts agricultural production, brands find themselves at risk. And so we see an increasing appetite from brands here in the United States to find ways to secure the supply chain. And typically what that means is, step number one, knowing who's there. Like knowing Starbucks needs to know which farmers are actually producing the coffee that it's sourcing. And then once you know what the supply chain is, who's in it, then you can start to deploy interventions, whether it's access to capital, training, and other ways of support. That creates shared value. That creates value for the firm. It's not a philanthropic approach. It definitely has positive impact for farming and working communities around the world, but I think firms are increasingly realizing it's in their own interest to do that.
And I mean, with something like a fair trade, a label, I suppose, you put on it, what sort of premium, you know, will a firm be able to charge if it actually does say, I've complied with the fair trade approach and got your certification?
So if you look at the market research around organic products, fair trade products, and things like that, typically consumers are willing to pay 5, 10, maybe 15% premium. I think with organics, we've gotten used to the idea that to eat a healthier product, we're going to have to pay a little bit more money. And fair trade is kind of in the same band.
It's only a very small part of the overall consumer base that's willing to pay anything extra.
Yeah, what's amazing, I mean, we've crunched the numbers on some of these commodities, just a 10% markup for us as consumers translates into often a 50 or even 100% increase in wages for farmers and workers. So with a very small premium on this side of the market, we can impact big change on the other side of the world.
I mean, what do you think it is that's holding consumers back from being willing to pay a bit extra? Because, I mean, as you say, I mean, 10%, if you're going to, you know, many of these products, I mean, they're not very high, very expensive products, even if you add 10% to them.
Honestly, I think we're in a moment of real awakening in terms of consumerism. We call it conscious consumerism, and every year you see more data and more evidence that we, as a people, are increasingly being more mindful about the things that we buy. We want to know, where does our food come from? And is it healthy? Is it sustainable? Is there child labor in it? Was there deforestation? This is not the majority of U.S. consumers yet, but it's a rapidly growing segment, and it's a trend-setting segment. Millennials in particular index very high in terms of their desire for more responsible and more sustainable products. And so I'm really encouraged, actually, by what we're seeing in terms of mindful shopping or conscious consumerism, because, you know, I think the business community, for the most part, is hungry for more sustainable business models. But, you know, they're held to a financial bottom line that doesn't allow them to throw money away. And so there has to be a business model there that is supported by the consumer in order for us to make progress on what I would think of as a new age of globalization.
So, Paul, I mean, as you look at companies that are catering to the emerging middle classes of the developing world, I mean, is there a more of a ethical consumer, conscious consumer mindset? Is there a desire to build sustainability into the business models that you're investing in?
Well, certainly many, if not all, of the businesses that we invest in are out to make a difference in the world. And in so doing, I mean, we deliberately try to invest in companies where that is actually baked into the product that they're creating, right? So if you're a solar lanterns company, you know, every solar lantern that you sell is going to reach, you know, four or five more people that don't have access to reliable electricity, et cetera, et cetera. And hence your impact is going to scale along with your own growth. What's interesting, though, is kind of bridging back to what Paul was saying. We are absolutely seeing and benefiting in the world of impact investing from this rise in people wanting to do good. And I think, you know, that is evident in things like the rise of B Corps and benefit corporations, the rise of impact investing overall, right? You know, so we're seeing these
just
trends.
Just tell people
take
who
hold.
Don't know, I mean, what's a B Corporation?
So these are companies that, and there's varying levels of commitment, right? One of them is simply to sort of take this public vow, so to speak, and certify that you're out there to make a difference in the world, and you're going to measure your social impact, and you're going to measure things like potentially your supply chain. You get to decide what are the elements that you're going to measure, all the way up to where you can actually legally lock it in, so that, for example, you may be an early stage startup, but you go through an acquisition or an IPO, and your mission is baked in, so your new owners need to honor that mission. And that's, you know, that's a really interesting trend that's rising.
And there's companies like Etsy, the online
marketplace.
Patagonia, yeah. Warby Parker.
Yeah, and smaller ones. And and it's very interesting. But I guess I was gonna, kind of bridging these two threads. It's also not surprising to me that this real hunger to do good, and especially from millennials, it starts with the stuff that's most tangible to you. Right? So what are you putting in your body? Not surprising that organics is kind of the leading edge. What are you doing with your life? Right? So a lot of benefit corporations, they'll say one of the main reasons that they want to be a B Corp or a benefit corp is actually it's really motivating to their workers, right? And in the war for talent, this is a huge advantage. And then we kind of go layers out into like, how are the products that we're having affecting other people in the world? But I think these are all part of a larger whole that is, in many ways, a very positive part of what's going on in globalization.
And just talk a bit more about, you've written this report, Frontier Capital. I mean, what lay behind that decision to write that report? Why is it needed? What problem are you addressing?
I guess a couple of things. So, number one, we see this, as we just talked about, this rise in interest in impact investing and B corporations and whatnot, and simultaneously a lot of talk about the BOP, the very poorest of the poor. And we actually wanted to spark a discussion and potentially a debate about where can you actually use for-profit strategies to make a difference and where can't you? And we're very clear in this report that actually when you're dealing with the poorest of the poor, it's very hard to marry financial returns and social impact, and you may need things that require more subsidy. But this layer between the very poorest of the poor and the established middle class, there's a huge undertapped potential there. And wanting to have a call to action, or both for commercial VCs, who frankly have a lot to benefit from getting in on this growing wave, to impact investors and whatnot to take advantage of this growing opportunity. So that was really the emphasis.
So, I mean, I guess that, if you rolled back the clock 10, 15 years, people would say, aid for the bottom of the pyramid and then, I guess, free trade to let the big companies come in and create jobs in those countries. But now you're saying that basically there's this third layer in the middle, in a sense.
Yeah, exactly. And these middle classes in some countries, like India and China, like they're off to the races, right? Middle class in China is like unbelievably large. But when you start going one layer down, there's all this unmet need and this rising potential to meet it through tools that we're not used to. We're used to thinking in a very bifurcated fashion. You want to solve a problem, either the free markets are going to take care of it, or it's going to be government and subsidy. And there's this really interesting spot in between that's super promising.
And it's interesting because, is the audience for this report Silicon Valley? Because it seems to me the venture capital community here, is one of the least global groups of investors that you come across. I mean, they expect people to come here, but they don't actually want to go out to India or whatever and see the opportunities out there. Is that right?
So realistically, we're targeting venture capitalists that are already in emerging markets, and there are quite a few, right? Established, Sequoia, Matrix, Kazakh. These are folks that are doing quite well, that are by and large already serving the middle class and starting to serve lower income groups and calling out this undertapped opportunity.
Do you think there could be a lot more people here that have money that could be doing a lot more investing?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And why do you think they don't?
Well, I think it's a mix of things. You know, number one, pragmatically, it's easier to invest in the places you know, right? So at Omidyar Network, you know, we do have an office here in Silicon Valley. We have a really big office in Mumbai. We have an office in Joburg. We have, with a reason, because you don't just like plunk down into a country that you don't know and start investing. You're probably not going to make very great deals, right? And so, you know, as we see the spread of VC go to these countries, this is the natural extension of that.
I wanted to ask a bit about, we think about globalization often in sort of terms of Western values being spread around, Western companies sort of investing abroad. But, you know, obviously globalization is also about countries like China and India extending their reach. I mean, are they, probably our prejudice would be that they would be, probably the balance of risk and of rewards and costs would be worse for China and India as they globalize than has been the case with Europe and America. Would that be fair?
I think it's more complicated than that. If you go back, say, 15, 20 years to the MFN debate in the United States' most favored nation, which was kind of the first big debate over how to do business or invest in China from the US, there was an argument that the virtue of Western companies would lead to changes in China. And the reality today is the exact opposite has happened. The Chinese government has been very good at shaping the way Western companies operate in that environment versus the other way around. So, and that's shown itself abroad too, as China moves out into, say, Africa, investing in commodities and other things. I mean, I think that there's been a very, very clear business model that they've tried to promote that doesn't necessarily enhance rights or others like that. But on the same side, if you go back 50 or 100 years and even 10 years in places like Angola, the major problems in, say, the oil sector with corruption and other things were done when Western investors were the only investors. So to me, what that says is unless your rules and standards are right, nobody is a white knight in any meaningful way. And what that requires is scrutiny. So I think what you see over and over again is where people aren't paying attention, where people aren't aware certain problematic practices are occurring, and where nobody's pushing for those to change, whether you're from San Francisco or Shanghai or Mumbai or anywhere else, you can potentially get away with a lot of things that you shouldn't.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Arvind Gunnison of Human Rights Watch, Paula Goldman of Omidyar Network, and Paul Rice of Fairtrade USA. This conversation is moderated by Matthew Bishop of The Economist. The program was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation.
You know, one of the things this brings us to is, you know, your organization's called Fair Trade, but trade has become, well, from the start, really, one of the driving forces of globalization. You had the GATT round and then the creation of the World Trade Organization, and there was a sense of, you know, you just had to take down the barriers, and there was a resistance to putting in ethical rules or protections as part of that trading regime, whether it be NAFTA or anything else. And I mean, I wonder, you know, we've just had this big trade deal announced with the Pacific nations, and, you know, Hillary Clinton's position on it seems to be a hot topic at the moment. We don't know whether she was a favorite before she was against it and so forth. But what do you think, Paul? I mean, are we learning anything from the failures of the previous or the successes of previous trade liberalization agreements? And are we getting in the right direction?
Well, I think so, absolutely. And, you know, I would suggest that turning back the clock on globalization and turning back the clock on free trade is not really an option at this point. So, you know, the mission of fair trade is to help free trade work better for the poor. You know, in our movement, we're absolutely not against lowering of trade barriers and acceleration of trade. We just want to make sure that the small family farmer on the mountaintop isn't left behind by that opening up of market opportunities, or that factory workers in countries around the world are not just a source of cheap labor for global brands, and that they are brought into the global economy and into the formal economy in a way that provides dignity to their lives, better wages and safer working conditions. And Arvind just spoke to the issue of scrutiny, and I absolutely believe that that scrutiny of labor practices as these trade agreements go forward and more firms come into the formal global economy and trade is accelerated, that the scrutiny of labor practices is key to the equation. I think traditionally we've thought of scrutiny fairly narrowly in terms of government regulation. And then in the 80s and since then, a whole industry of codes of conduct and of factory auditing and farm auditing emerged, and fair trade certification is kind of a part of that industry. We send auditors into factories and onto farms every year to verify fair labor conditions, safe working conditions, and so on. But I would argue that we're at the cusp of a whole new model of scrutiny. And in fact, my colleague, Heather Franzese, who leads an organization called Good World Solutions, is speaking this afternoon here. And Good World Solutions is bringing technology into the mix in order to give workers voice. So adding worker scrutiny, if you will, to the mix, and through cell phone technology and through voice, through surveys that are administered through voice recognition, we're able now to gather fantastic data on working conditions, wages, and other important indicators. Not just the 2 days of the year that the auditor is in the factory, but the other 363 days of the year when the auditor isn't there. So I'm really excited about how technology is going to enable a much more worker-empowered global workforce in the future, where there will be no secrets around labor practices in the future.
Before we talk a bit more about that, I mean, the standard criticisms you read about free trade agreements, you know, one is that they typically remove labor protections. And the second is there's this sort of, they bring in protections for investors to basically, you know, be protected against governments changing their policies in ways that adversely affect investors. I mean, are those criticisms fair, or do you
think
they were? Yeah, they are. So you would actually like to see, you'd like to see those.
I just think it's irreversible. The trend is irreversible. So I want to see workers and firms find their common ground, if you will, on an economic platform in which both sides win.
But I mean, to that point, I think that governments have had to respond to that criticism. So with TPP, the latest trade agreement, the U.S. government is supposed to roll out some pretty dramatically new labor protections for at least Malaysia, Vietnam, and Brunei as a result of this kind of pressure and negotiations. And they've already announced that there will be a cutout in investor state dispute mechanisms for tobacco, which has kind of driven a lot of the legitimate criticism of the use of that mechanism for inappropriate purposes. Mm-hmm. And then finally, and this is yet to be seen because the US government hasn't really disclosed it, they've also claimed that they're going to do some things that will help protect internet freedom, like putting some controls on whether a country can force companies to localize their data. Now, all of this is from USTR, so none of us here would just believe it at face value. But that, to me, at a minimum, is a response to the reality that a number of people have been posing for years, that these just cannot be purely economic agreements. They have to have some social protections at their heart as well.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess one of the questions that's sort of emerging from the conversation we're having is that, I mean, there is this hope that a private sector, you know, response, whether it be consumer pressure or worker pressure, transparency and so forth, will be able to get us a long way along the route of correcting some of the flaws in globalization. But I wonder, you know, how much can the private sector do without better multilateral, international government action, treaties that really, you know, are binding and so forth and enforced. I mean, what do we need to do policy-wise to actually help?
I mean, in my view, the law is always the last to follow when it comes to social protections, and often it only shows up when something really bad has gone wrong, right? I mean, if you look at environmental, antitrust, anti-corruption, or health and safety laws, that's the lesson. Government is terrible at this. And in a globalized world, what you'll have is a combination of different types of scrutiny, regulation eventually, but it'll probably be the last thing you see. But there is also what's quasi-regulation. It's investors saying, we're not going to put money into companies doing irresponsible things. It's customers saying, we're not going to buy a product that's going to do this. It's lawsuits. It's public scrutiny and criticism that can be quite withering. So I think in a globalized world, you can't just look to a traditional model of one government regulating its companies. You look to all of these actors in their own way, essentially creating a quasi-regulatory environment simultaneously.
So at Midirnark, we operate less in the world of like, here are regulations you need to follow, and more in the, here is this innovation we want to scale. And in that world, government plays a really powerful role and a positive one, right? And not just in the kind of regulations and stuff like that, but in sending a message that says, hey, pay attention to this. We always reference back to the early days of venture capital when a small change in policy from the US government saying to pension funds, hey, but you know, when people were nervous that venture capital could actually be viable, and a small change in policy saying, like, hey, it's actually prudent to invest in venture capital, all of a sudden the floodgates open, right? And we saw this, we were really encouraged to see last month the U.S. IRS, come out with a clarification that said to U.S. foundations, hey, you guys can use your endowments in line with your mission. Go ahead and do this, right? And so there are ways beyond the sort of, carrot and stick approach, right, that can also guide people in the right direction.
I mean, do you see any real sign, though, of the major investment institutions where we all put our retirement savings and things? Are they really changing their attitude in any way to take account of the kind of world that their investments are creating?
Yes. And I think it's just the start of it, and there's a lot more to grow. But in the last few years, we've seen Bain start an impact investing practice, BlackRock, all the major private banks, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley. And these are, let's be candid, the money that's being played with is a small, small fraction of what the overall assets under management are, but it's a pretty promising trend.
Yeah, and if you go abroad, I mean, last year I met with ABG, which is the largest Dutch pension fund. I mean, I think it's several hundred billion dollars. They have set up whole units looking at human rights issues, environmental and others, not only because they think it's the right thing, but also because that's what their clients are asking them to do as well.
So let's imagine briefly, what is this new global civil society movement or consumer movement that is emerging that you referred to, Paul? What's it look like in 5 years' time? What's going to change, and how is that going to affect how globalization works?
Well, I think clearly consumers are going to be more engaged in the next 5 years. They're going to be increasingly looking for brands and products that speak to their values socially and environmentally. They're going to be increasingly holding firms accountable for practices and rewarding firms with their purchases and their loyalty when those firms produce more responsible products. And I think that's only part of the equation for the business community. I think the business community is definitely motivated by that consumer trend, but I also believe that the business community is increasingly concerned about supply chain insecurity from a reputational perspective, of course, but also from simply a product access. And if it's agriculture, the business community is really concerned about how climate change is going to impact flow of goods, flow of food and other agricultural products in the future. And so I think even setting aside the rise of the conscious consumer and that business opportunity, for companies. I think companies are also going to want to go deeper over the next 5 years in terms of kind of peeling back the curtain and knowing where products come from and ensuring that at the very least, minimal standards are met. Now, minimal standards don't necessarily ameliorate poverty or bad labor practices, right? So I think that's the challenge. How do we go beyond minimal standards to higher and higher standards in which workers and farmers are really joining the journey on an upward spiral?
And do you feel there's this new global civil society emerging?
I think there's global recognition. If you look around the world right now, particularly in Europe and even in places like India, there have actually been a lot of rules passed that are requiring companies to disclose what they're doing on social activities. And that's new. It's not enforcement or anything, but it signals that there's a recognition that this is important to people. Even in the US, there are new disclosure laws. When companies invest more than $500,000 in Burma, they have to disclose human rights policies, whether they're dealing with the military and others. And that's not because the US government or anybody else woke up one day and thought it'd be a good idea. It's because that's a demand they're facing. And so I think that element of it's going to grow, but I think that two of the bigger challenges, or three, are there are governments out there that are trying to close the space and make it harder to scrutinize these things, and that's going to continue. Secondly, income inequality is going to color a lot of these discussions in ways we don't see. It's not simply about raising incomes through protecting rights. It's also greater scrutiny of the predatory and exploitative practices that purely target the poor, whether it's by the private sector or others. And then finally, climate change, I think, is going to change a lot of the way people look at this. I mean, I think supply chains, you know, can be looked at both from an environmentally sustainable standpoint as well as a labor rights or other standpoint. And increasingly, everything is going to be looked at together. And the scrutiny that a company is going to face or others is going to be far more layered and more important as well.
I mean, it's interesting you mention sort of the closing of the public civil society space. And I've written recently about, I think one of the ways in which globalization is definitely under threat is that more and more countries are passing laws that restrict foreign donations to their local nonprofits. And so Russia, I think, was the country that really started that trend, but now a growing number of countries, including China, seem to be going down that route. I mean, how big a problem is that?
It's an enormous problem when you think about what has happened, and actually it existed in India for years. And so basically what the problem is that if you're the Ford Foundation or Omidyar or anybody else, governments are restricting whether a local nonprofit can get money from you, or restricting the amount, or even just banning it in some way. And in Russia, they accuse you of being a spy and a foreign agent, and you're subject to audits and arrests and things like that. But it's happened around the world. Ethiopia did it a few years ago, and they specifically targeted independent human rights organizations. So, I mean, it's both sides of globalization. The fact that money can flow globally for these purposes means that governments are restricting them nationally because they don't want those people doing what they're doing.
So it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned Ethiopia, and I think Rwanda is another example where, if you talk to USAID or a number of the development agencies, they like those countries because they seem to be improving the well-being of the population. And yet, at the same time, I know Human Rights Watch has been very critical of the political behavior of the governments, which are cracking down on human rights.
Well, but even in Ethiopia, you've got to look at who's the beneficiary of the development, right? So a lot of the praise of a place like Ethiopia is because of what it's done in aggregate. But what happens when you divide this room in half and you give the left side everything and the right side nothing? Well, in aggregate, it looks like you've done a great job, but in reality, something very different has happened. And with the kind of political discrimination in aid in Ethiopia and elsewhere, that's exactly what's happened. And so this goes to the point of scrutiny and oversight, is that if somebody isn't there paying attention to that development, then yes, you take a step back and you think everything's great, when in fact, that's not precisely what's happened at all.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, Omidyar, you talk about how you do for-profit investments, and you also give grants to nonprofits. I mean, you're big in India. Is it easier for you to do for-profit than nonprofit in India?
Say so necessarily. And But I would also say we've managed just fine to, you know, to operate, and that it's actually our biggest office outside of the United States, and we think it's a very, very important place to be playing. But I was going to say there's also one, I don't know if it's a silver lining to the situation that you were discussing, but, you know, there's a real need for capital that's from India to work on these problems, and capital coming in from the outside doesn't necessarily have the best understanding of all the things that are going on, right? So one of our, you know, one of our efforts that tends to be more nonprofit than for-profit is around government transparency and civic innovation, and you can see a kind of complex dynamic if all that money was coming in from the outside. And so there was a very concerted effort in India to activate philanthropists and, you know, corporate donors and stuff like that to say, like, hey, this is an Indian problem. Let's have Indian stakeholders address it. And we've seen a big rise in that. So a bit of a silver lining to that situation.
So we've got a question here from the audience, which is about the Pope, who appears to believe that sort of an unending emphasis on prosperity is immoral. And yet at the same time he's promoting an emphasis on bringing people out of poverty. To what extent, the question is this focus on prosperity, which is at the heart of the globalization process, is it vital to, is the Pope right that this is a problem? Paul.
Oh, man. Don't make me talk about the Pope, please.
Come on.
I'm a big fan of the Pope.
But?
No, there's no but there. I mean, conveniently, perhaps, I tend to focus more on the Pope's opinions about helping the poor. Mm. But I don't think those two are contradictory. I mean, you know, growth is not a bad thing. Growth and generation of new economic wealth is not a bad thing. Again, it's, are we all sharing in that growth and prosperity?
Yeah, I mean, you raise this fundamental question, as she does as well, about inequality. I mean, is globalization, this increasing globalization, is that behind why the world seems to be in some ways becoming much more unequal?
I mean, on a more kind of philosophical basis, the way we kind of look at it, and we had to kind of confront this issue when we first started this work at Human Rights Watch, is it's not that people care or are critical of success, in a sense. It's making sure that the floor isn't so low that there's no actual floor, right? So if people do well, that's great, but if your labor laws or if the practices against the poor are so exploitative that they can't get out of that trap and actually suffer for it, then that's where your problem is. So I would say that it's not so much about prosperity as much as is that floor the appropriate floor, and that's kind of where the focus should be.
And maybe a word that I would use in place of prosperity is access to opportunity, mm-hmm. right? And were you there when the Pope did his address on impact investing?
No.
You weren't. So one of like, for a total impact investing wonk like myself, one of the highlights of the last few years was that there was a gathering at the Vatican where the Pope was talking, gave an official address about impact investing and the power of markets to help lift the poor out of poverty. And so even there, there's not a bifurcated thinking. It was an embrace of the complex opportunities that we face.
So there's a question here about climate change, which I think does go to the heart of, you know, the question of whether we are managing globalization very well. I mean, to what extent does our failure to really address the climate change threat, you know, show that the globalization process we have is very badly flawed? Paul.
Well, so thanks for the fastball down the middle. Look, I think the failure to address climate change in a holistic and global way is a failure of government, not a failure of globalization per se. I mean, when I think about globalization, I think about the globalization of markets and capital and opportunity and inclusion. And what's both good about that, what's working well, and what isn't. And so for me, the climate change, while it's certainly the inability of governments to get on the same page, and our government in particular, to really step up and do what it needs to do around climate change, I think ultimately is a failure of political will and a failure of us to hold our politicians accountable.
And Amidyar, are you investing on the basis that, you know, you can do something about climate change at all?
So We invest in a couple of key verticals: education, financial inclusion, consumer internet, and mobile. I think that's we're not explicitly doing something on climate change, but that has mostly to do with our analysis of like what's the size of our capital and where is it going to make the most difference. And really an emphasis on early stage innovation. So there's some stuff that's related that we're doing, you know, around off-grid energy and solar energy and stuff like that. But we don't have the wherewithal or the strategy to go after the more sort of capital-intensive stuff that really needs to happen on the innovation front to address, from a business perspective, the climate change challenge. But it's urgent. I mean, I think we all get that.
There's a question here also about... I guess there were earlier forms of globalization, which were colonial expansions and so forth, and you know, so many of the developing countries were part of were subject to a colonial power in the past. And to what extent should that, a sense of reparation of correct putting right past injustices, you know, be more overtly part of our policy, economic policy towards those countries?
Wow.
These are big.
Yeah,
no,
I mean, being from India, I can say this. So, I mean, I think there are two levels to it. One is, I mean, yeah, colonialization was extractive, and now it's very different, right? It's not about simply holding territory and extracting natural resources or labor or anything, and then trading it in another market. It's that globalization means now the market is indigenous as well as global and everywhere else. So it's Indian investors, it's U.S. investors, it's everybody. And the way I look at that is, if you don't want to say that one group of entrepreneurs is favored over another, you want the rules to be the same for the people that might be hurt by what isn't paid attention to. And I mean, India is a great example of this. And you mentioned the social clause in the early GATT debates. Well, India was at the forefront of opposing any labor standards and international trade agreements, but the irony was India's domestic laws were better than any international standard would have been in any trade agreement, and they didn't want to enforce them, right? So what this to me, and I was there at the time getting yelled at pretty much everybody for whether Human Rights Watch opposed or was for the social clause, I mean, it taught me a pretty valuable lesson that at the end of the day, what you do nationally in terms of how you protect people is more important than what you say about certain elements of globalization.
Yeah. You both agree with that? Or?
I would actually point out a different angle here, right? Just like the world is changing super rapidly. And it's not that those questions are not important. They're extremely important. But I don't look out and see a world where, you know, there's one or two major powers all based in the West that are extracting from mm-hmm. the rest. I see a world where, like, there are multivalent centers of power. And we're increasingly competing as opposed, you know, and that's where I feel is most urgent to look at, right?
So we've got time for one last question. I'd like to ask each of you, if we were to come back here in 5 years and have the same conversation, what would be the one thing that you would most like to be able to say has improved about the way globalization works? I'll start with you, Arvind.
For me, I would like to be able to say the baseline has changed in terms of what both the conduct and expectation of companies are, and even governments and others, on how they conduct their business anywhere, so that it's not just...
And the baseline specifically in what sense?
In terms of how, say, they treat their workers, how their impact on the local community and their, I mean, you know, in a broader sense, their sustainability throughout their supply chain. And that's not just the purview of either progressively minded companies or governments, but it's kind of the expectation everybody has.
Paul?
I would hope that in 5 years, the business community has really cracked the code on how to create a global supply chain and a global business model that is transparent and that creates shared value not only for the firm, but also for farmers and workers around the world, and really brings them in a much more inclusive and empowered way into the global economy. And then that whole model is supported by us, by conscious consumers really voting with our dollars for products and for companies that are making a difference.
And you think that change at the consumer level is that it would be the most significant factor that would make that happen?
I think these are two macro trends. I think the business community is realizing that they're burning the candle at both ends right now anyway, and they're trying to find a better model. But I think the consumer is a critical. It's not one or the other. I think it's both.
Paula?
I would say the same way we decades ago saw venture capital go from kind of a crazy idea to a very established industry, and more recently emerging markets private equity make the same leap and establish itself, that in 5 years it would just be the natural course of business that venture capitalists and private equity folks are looking at services for the low and lower middle income groups, and that in the process, the billions of people that fall into those groups have way more access to products and services that can help stabilize and improve opportunities.
And what do you think is the thing that most needs to happen for that change to occur?
Let me be clear, this is gonna happen. The macro forces are shifting in this direction. I want this to happen more quickly. And what's needed for that are pioneers, really, are people that are gonna go in and take risks before everyone else sees the opportunity, right? And that's one of the things we talk about in the report. Like, there's some of the stuff that's really easy, There's some of the stuff that's relatively easier, that is proven business models that, you know, you're taking from other countries and bringing into emerging markets. The stuff that's harder and where more creative leadership is are business models that are designed solely for these groups, right? Whether it's sort of affordable housing finance or it's cook stoves or something like that, right? Where you need investors to go in and say, I really believe in this. I may need to finance this a little bit more creatively, but once we have time to de-risk these models, we're going to show that these are viable businesses, and then people are going to rush in.
And we've had a couple of cards say they'd like you to ground what Omidyar does in some more specific examples. So I just wonder whether, if you had to pick a company in your portfolio in the emerging markets that you think might become a bit of a household name over the next 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah,
tell us about that. Which company is it? Tell us what it...
Oh, it's so hard to pick one. One of my recent favorites, there's a company called MicroInsure, which does what it sounds like, microinsurance for folks that are living precariously, right? So any small income shock, it could be like a funeral of a family member, might then just totally gut the ability for you to send your kid to school or something like that. And so this group has partnered with major telecoms to get access to very small microinsurance policies out to folks out in rural areas. The combined market cap of the telecoms that they've partnered with, like Sanlam and others, is something like $70 billion. They're reaching millions and millions of people. Right, so very smart technology play, very smart economic play, making a massive difference and stabilizing the lives of a lot of people. That's one. Another is one I've vaguely mentioned already, which is D-Lite, which is around affordable solar lighting. So these are devices that, you know, are pretty, they're made affordably. There's also financing mechanisms to get them even more affordably. And if you think about if you face unreliable electricity and you can't keep your business open at night, can't keep a doctor's office open at night. This is the kind of thing that's making a massive difference in many, many regions around the world.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, this has actually been a much more upbeat conversation about globalization than I think I'd expected going in. And I'd like to thank, on behalf of the World Affairs Council, Arvind Ganison, Paula Goldman, and Paul Rice for their enlightening and optimistic remarks. And thank you, the audience, for your participation. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Featured in this episode was Arvind Ganison from Human Rights Watch, Paula Goldman from Omidyar Network, and Paul Rice from Fairtrade USA. The conversation was moderated by Matthew Bishop of The Economist. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to listen to our programs, to register to attend an upcoming event, or to become a council member. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is David Ogilvie. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.